can't go in either. 'Cause I'm too big. My little sister bobbed her head.
Right. You've gotten too big to get in. And what's really amazing about that place is that it's darker than anything could ever be. So dark it feels like when you turn off the flashlight, you can grab the darkness with your hands. And when you're there in the dark by yourself, it's like your body is gradually coming apart and disappearing. But since it's dark, you can't see that. You don't know if you still have a body or not. But even if, say, my body completely disappeared, I'd still remain there. Like the Cheshire Cat's grin remaining after he vanished. Pretty weird, huh? But when I was there, I didn't think it was weird at all. I wanted to stay there forever, but I thought you'd be worried, so I came out.
Let's get out of here, I said. She was so worked up it seemed like she was going to go on talking forever, and I had to put a stop to that. I can't breathe well in here.
Are you okay?
My sister asked, worried. I'm okay, I just want to go outside. Holding hands, we headed for the exit.
Do you know?
My sister said in a small voice as we walked so no one else would hear, though there wasn't anyone else around.
Alice really existed. It wasn't made up, it was real. The March Hare, the Walrus, the Cheshire Cat, the Playing Card Soldiers, they all really exist.
Maybe so, I said. We emerged from the windhole, back to the bright, real world. There was a thin layer of clouds in the sky that afternoon, but I remember how terribly bright the sunlight seemed. The screech of the cicadas was overpowering, like a violent squall drowning out everything. My uncle was seated on a bench near the entrance, absorbed in a book. When he saw us, he grinned and stood up. 2 years later, my sister died and was put in a tiny coffin and cremated. I was 15 and she was 12. While she was being cremated, I went off, apart from the rest of the family, sat on a bench in the courtyard of the crematorium, and remembered what had happened in that windhole. The weight of time as I waited by that small cave for my little sister to come out. The thickness of the darkness enveloping me. The chill I felt to my core. Her black hair emerging from the hole. Then her shoulders slowly coming out. All the random dirt and dust stuck to her white t-shirt. At that time, a thought struck me. That even before the doctor at the hospital officially pronounced her dead 2 years later, maybe her life had already been snatched from her while she was deep inside that cave. I was actually convinced of it. She'd already been lost within that hole and left this world, but I, mistakenly thinking she was still alive, had put her on the train with me and taken her back to Tokyo, holding her hand tightly, and we'd lived as brother and sister for 2 more years. But this was nothing more than a fleeting grace period. 2 years later, death had crawled out of that cave to grab hold of my sister's soul. Like time was up, it was necessary to pay for what had been lent out, and the owner had come to get back what was his. At any rate, now, at 36, I realized again that what my little sister had confided to me in a quiet voice in that windhole was indeed true. Alice really does exist in the world. The March Hare, the Walrus, the Cheshire Cat, they all really exist. And the Commendatore, too, of course. The weather report was off the mark and we didn't have a rainstorm. Just after 5, a very light rain began, so fine that you could hardly tell if it was falling or not, and continued till the next morning. Right at 6 p.m., a large, shiny black sedan slowly made its way up the slope. It reminded me of a hearse, but of course it wasn't one, but the limousine Manchiki had sent for me. A Nissan Infiniti.
The driver in black uniform and hat alighted from the car and, umbrella in one hand, came over to the front door and rang the bell. I opened the door and he took off his hat and made sure of my name. I left the house and got into the car. I declined the umbrella. It wasn't raining hard enough for one. The driver opened the rear door for me. Once I was inside, he closed it with a solid thunk, a little different from the sound of Manchiki's Jaguar. I wore a black, light, round-necked sweater, gray herringbone jacket, dark gray wool trousers, and black suede shoes. The most formal outfit I owned. At least it didn't have paint stains. Even after the limo came, the Commendatore still hadn't appeared, and I hadn't heard his voice. So I had no way of making sure he'd remembered the invitation from Manchiki. But he must have. He'd been looking forward to it so much there was no way he'd forgotten. But I worried for nothing. Soon after the car had set off, I suddenly found the Commendatore, with a nonchalant look on his face, seated beside me. He was dressed in his usual white outfit, looking like it had just come from the cleaners without a single stain, with the jewel-encrusted long sword at his waist. He was, as always, about 2 feet high. The whiteness and purity of his clothes stood out even more against the black leather seats of the Infinity. He stared straight ahead, his arms folded. "Do not say anything to me," the Commendatore said, as if reminding me. "My friends can see me, but others cannot. My friends can hear me, but others cannot. If you talk to something that cannot be seen, people will think you are very strange. Affirmative? Nod, please, if you understand." I nodded slightly one time. The Commendatore bobbed his head in response, and afterward sat there silently, his arms folded. It was dark out. The crows had already withdrawn to their mountain roosts. The Infinity slowly descended the slope, drove down the road in the valley, and came to a steep slope. It wasn't that long a distance, we were just going to the other side of a narrow valley, after all. But the road was narrow, with plenty of curves, the type of road a driver of a large sedan would not be happy to navigate. The type of road more suited to a four-wheel drive military vehicle. But the driver's expression didn't change a bit as he calmly handled the car, and we arrived safely at Manchiki's mansion. The mansion was surrounded by a high white wall with a solid gate in front. Large wooden double doors painted a dark brown, like the castle gate in an Akira Kurosawa film set in the Middle Ages, the kind that would look good with a couple of arrows embedded in it. The inside was completely hidden from view. Next to the gate was a plate with a house number, but no nameplate. Probably no need to have one. If someone was going to go to the trouble of coming all the way up to the top of this mountain, they would automatically know this was Manchiki's mansion. The area around the gate was brightly lit by mercury lamps. The driver got out, rang the bell, and spoke for a moment with someone on the intercom. Then he got back in his seat and waited for the gate to open remotely. There were two movable security cameras, one on each side of the gate. The double doors slowly opened inward, and the driver entered, proceeding leisurely down the curving road on the grounds. The road was a gentle downward slope. I heard the doors close behind us, a heavy sound, as if informing us that there was no return to the world from which we had come. Pine trees lined both sides of the road, all neatly trimmed. The branches were beautifully arranged, like bonsai, and careful measures were obviously taken to keep them from getting any disease. Along the road was also a trim hedge of azaleas. Beyond this, there were Japanese roses and a clump of camellias. The house might be new, but the trees and plants all seemed to have been there since long ago. All of these were beautifully illuminated by garden lanterns. The road ended in a circular asphalt-covered driveway. As soon as the driver parked, he He leaped out the driver's side and opened the back door for me. I looked beside me, but didn't see the commendatore. But I wasn't particularly surprised and didn't mind. He had his own patterns of behavior. The taillights of the Infinity politely and gracefully disappeared into the twilight darkness, leaving me standing there alone. Seen from the front like this, the house looked much cozier and less imposing than I'd expected. When I'd looked at it from across the valley, it seemed like an overbearing, gaudy structure. Perhaps the impression changed depending on the angle. The front gate was at the highest point of the mountain, and then, descending the slope, the house was built as if to deliberately make use of the angle of inclination of the land. On either side of the front door were two old stone statues, a pair of the Komainu guardian dog figures found in Shinto shrines, on pedestals as well. They might actually have been real Komainu brought over from somewhere. There were plantings of azaleas at the entrance too. In May, the place must be pretty colorful. As I slowly walked toward the front door, it opened from inside and Menshiki appeared. He had on a dark green cardigan over a white button-down shirt and cream-colored chinos. His pure white hair was, as always, neatly combed and arranged naturally. It felt strange to see Menshiki welcoming me to his own house. I'd always seen Menshiki when he roared up to my house in his Jaguar. He invited me in and closed the front door. The entrance foyer was spacious and nearly square, with a high ceiling. A squash court could fit inside. The indirect lighting on the wall pleasantly lit the room, and on top of a large octagonal parquet table in the middle of the foyer was a large flower vase, Ming Dynasty by the look of it, overflowing with a fresh flower arrangement. A mix of three different types of large flowers. I don't know much about plants, so don't know the names. Probably he'd had them specially arranged just for this evening. A frugal college student could manage to live for a month on what Menshiki probably paid the florist. At least I could have, back when I was a student. There were no windows in the foyer, just a skylight in the ceiling. The floor was well-polished marble. The living room was down three wide steps, and though not quite big enough for a soccer field, was definitely large enough for a tennis court. The southeast side was all tinted glass, with a large deck outside. It was dark, so I couldn't tell if you could see the ocean from here, but I imagine you could. On the opposite wall was an open fireplace. It wasn't the cold season yet, so there was no fire lit, but firewood was neatly stacked up beside it, so a fire could be started at any time. I don't know who had stacked it up, but it was placed so beautifully it looked like a work of art in itself. There was a mantelpiece above the fireplace, with a row of old Meissen figurines. The living room floor was also marble, but covered with a variety of rugs. Antique Persian rugs, with such exquisite patterns and colors, they looked less like practical objects than artistic handicrafts. I hesitated to step on them. There were several low tables and a scattering of flower vases, all full of fresh flowers. Each vase looked like a valuable antique. It was all in nice taste and expensive. Here's hoping we don't have a big earthquake, was my thought. The ceiling was high, the lighting subdued. Refined indirect lighting on the walls, a few floor lamps, and reading lamps on the tables. At the back of the room was a black grand piano. I'd never seen a Steinway concert grand piano in a room like this, one that made it seem smaller than it was. On top of the piano was a metronome and sheet music. Perhaps Menshiki played, or maybe he invited Maurizio Pollini over for dinner every once in a while. Overall, though, the room was modestly decorated, and I felt relieved. There was nothing excessive, but it didn't have an empty feeling. A comfortable room, despite the size. There was a certain sense of warmth about it, you might say. Half a dozen tasteful paintings graced the walls, all modestly displayed. One of them looked like a real Leger, but I could have been mistaken. Menshiki motioned me to a large brown leather sofa. He sat on a matching easy chair across from me. The sofa was extremely comfortable, neither too hard nor too soft, the kind of sofa that naturally adjusted to whoever sat on it. Of course, if you think about it, not that it was something one had to think about, Menshiki wasn't about to put an uncomfortable sofa in his living room. As if he'd been waiting for us to get settled, as soon as we did, a man glided in from somewhere. A stunningly handsome young man. He wasn't so tall, but was slim and had a refined bearing about him. His skin was evenly tanned, with lustrous hair done up in a ponytail. He would look good at the beach, in surfing shorts, carrying a shortboard, though today he was dressed in a clean white shirt and black bow tie. A pleasant smile played about his lips. "Would you care for a cocktail?" he asked me. "Please order whatever you'd like." "I'll have a balalaika," I said, after considering it for a few seconds. Not that I really wanted a balalaika, but I wanted to test the young bartender to see if he really could make any kind of drink.
"I'll have the same," Menshiki said.
The young man smiled pleasantly and soundlessly withdrew. I glanced at the spot next to me on the sofa, but didn't see the commendatore. But he had to be here somewhere in the house. He'd ridden with me in the car up to the house, and had come along with me.
"Is something the matter?" Menshiki asked me.
He'd followed my glance. "No, just admiring your gorgeous house."
"It's a little too much, don't you think?"
Menshiki said, a smile rising to his face. "No, it's much more serene than I imagined," I answered honestly. "From a distance, it does look a bit luxurious, like a luxury cruise ship on the ocean. But inside, it's surprisingly relaxed. My impressions completely changed." Menshiki listened and nodded.
"I'm happy to hear that. But it took quite a lot of work to get it to that point. I bought the house already built, and when I purchased it, it was pretty gaudy. Flashy, you might say. A man who ran a big box store built it. The extremes of bad taste of the nouveau riche, you could say, and not my style at all. So I did a huge renovation after I bought it, which took a lot of time, effort, and money."
As if remembering all that work, Menshiki looked down and sighed. It really must not have suited his taste at all. "Wouldn't it have been a lot cheaper to build your own house?" I asked. Menshiki smiled, his white teeth peeking from between his lips.
"You're absolutely right. That would have been the sensible thing to do. But I had my own reasons. Reasons why it had to be this house and no other."
I waited for the story to go on, but it didn't.
"Wasn't the commendatore supposed to be with you tonight?"
Menshiki asked. "I think he'll be along later," I said. "We were together on the trip up to your house, and then he suddenly vanished. I think he must be taking a tour of your house. You don't mind, do you?"
Menshiki spread his hands wide. Of course I don't mind. He's welcome to look around as much as he likes."
The young man from before appeared, carrying two cocktails on a silver tray. The cocktail glasses were exquisitely cut crystal. Baccarat would be my guess. They glittered in the light from the floor lamp. Next to them was a Koimari ceramic plate with slices of various cheeses and cashews. There were small monogrammed linen napkins and a set of silver knives and forks. Everything well thought out. Menshiki and I picked up our cocktail glasses and made a toast. He toasted the completion of his portrait, and I thanked him. We lightly put our lips to the rim of the glasses. A balalaika is made of one part each of vodka, Cointreau, and lemon juice. A simple concoction, but unless it's as bitingly freezing as the North Pole, it doesn't taste good. If somebody who doesn't have the right touch mixes it, it ends up tasting diluted, watery. This balalaika was amazingly delicious, with an almost perfect bite to it.
"This is delicious," I said, impressed.
"He's quite good," Manshiki said lightly.
Of course he is, I thought. Manshiki wasn't about to hire a bad bartender. And of course he had Cointreau on hand, antique crystal glasses, and a Koimari serving plate. As we sipped our cocktails and munched on some nuts, we talked about various topics, mainly about my painting. He asked what I was working on now, and I explained. I told him I was working on a portrait of a man whose name and background I knew nothing about, someone I had encountered in a distant town.
"A portrait?"
Manshiki asked, sounding surprised.
"A portrait, but not a typical commercial portrait. More of an abstract style portrait, one in which I let my imagination run free. But the motif is definitely a portrait. You might say it's the foundation of the painting."
"Like when you painted my portrait?"
"Exactly, though this time I wasn't commissioned. It's something I decided to paint on my own."
Manshiki considered this.
"Maybe my portrait inspired you to be more creative?"
"No doubt, though I'm only at the point where my creativity is finally starting to kick in."
Manshiki took another soundless sip of his cocktail, with what I took to be a satisfied gleam deep in his eyes.
"Nothing could make me happier," he said. "The fact that I may have been of help to you, that is. If you don't mind, could I see that new painting when it's finished?"
"I'd be happy to show it to you, provided I'm happy with the result." I looked over at the grand piano in a corner of the room. "Do you play piano, Mr. Manshiki? That's a beautiful instrument."
Manshiki nodded slightly.
"I'm not good, but I do play a little. I took piano lessons as a child. 5 or 6 years from the time I entered elementary school until I graduated. Then I got busy with schoolwork and quit taking lessons. I wish I hadn't, but the piano lessons had worn me out. So my fingers don't move the way I'd like them to, but I'm good at reading sheet music. I play some simple pieces every once in a while just for my own amusement, for a change of pace. I'm not good enough to play for other people, and I never touch the keys when other people are here."
I went ahead and asked a question I'd been wanting to ask for a long time. "Doesn't it feel a little too spacious for you, living in such a big house all by yourself?"
"No, I don't think so," Manshiki replied immediately. "Not at all. I've always preferred being by myself. Consider the cerebral cortex for a moment. Humans are provided with a wonderfully precise and efficient cerebral cortex, but normally we use at most less than 10% of it. We've been divinely provided with this amazing, highly efficient organ, but sadly we haven't the ability to use it completely. You could compare it to a 4-person family living in a magnificent grand mansion, but only using one small room. All the other rooms are unused and neglected. When you think that way, it's not so unnatural that I live in this house by myself."
"When you put it that way, I suppose it makes sense," I said. It was an interesting analogy.
Manshiki rolled a few cashews around in his hand for a moment, and then spoke.
"That highly efficient cerebral cortex might seem wasted at first. But without it, we wouldn't be able to think abstract thoughts or enter the realm of the metaphysical. Even though we use but a small part of it, the cerebral cortex has that capacity. If we could use all the rest of it, what would we be capable of, I wonder? Isn't it fascinating to consider?"
"But in exchange for that efficient brain, the price we paid for that magnificent mansion, in other words, mankind had to neglect all kinds of basic abilities, right?"
"Exactly," Manshiki said. "Even without abstract thought or metaphysical theorizing, just standing on 2 legs and using clubs gave mankind more than enough skill to win the race for survival on Earth. These other abilities aren't that necessary, and in exchange for our hyper-capable cerebral cortexes, of necessity, we have to give up lots of other physical abilities. For example, dogs have a sense of smell several thousand times better than humans, and a sense of hearing tens of times better. But we're able to amass complex hypotheses. We're able to compare and contrast the cosmos and the microcosmos, and appreciate Van Gogh and Mozart. We can read Proust, if you want to, that is, and collect Koimairi porcelain and Persian rugs. Not something a dog can do. Marcel Proust used a sense of smell inferior to that of a dog's to write his lengthy novel. Manchiki laughed. That he did. I'm just speaking in generalities. The question then is whether or not an idea can be treated as an autonomous entity or not, right?
Exactly.
Exactly, the commendatore whispered into my ear, but following his earlier warning, I didn't look around me. After this, Manchiki led me into his study. There were broad stairs that led out of the living room, and we took them to the floor below. Somehow, these stairs seemed more than stairs, and part of the habitable space in the house. We went down the hallway past several bedrooms. I didn't count how many, but maybe one of them was the locked Bluebeard secret room my girlfriend spoke of, and at the end was the study. It wasn't an especially big room, but of course it wasn't cramped either. Built to be just the right amount of space. There were few windows in the study, just long, narrow windows like skylights near the ceiling on one wall. All that was visible from the windows were pine branches and the sky visible through the branches. The room didn't seem to particularly require sunlight or a view. Without many windows, the walls were that much bigger. One wall was floor-to-ceiling built-in bookcases, one section of which was for a shelf for CDs. The bookshelves were packed with books of all sizes. There was a wooden stepladder to reach the books on the upper shelves. All the books seemed to have been used at one time or another. It was clear that this was a practical collection used by a devoted reader, not decorative bookshelves. A large office desk faced away from one wall, with two computers on top, a desktop model and a laptop. There were a couple of cups holding pens and pencils, and a neat pile of paperwork. On another wall was a beautiful, expensive-looking stereo set, and on the opposite wall, facing directly across from the desk, sat a pair of tall, narrow speakers. They were about my height, 5'8", the cases made of high-quality mahogany. An Art Deco armchair for reading and listening to music was in the middle of the room, and next to it a stainless steel standing lamp for reading. I imagined that Manchiki spent a large part of his days alone in this room. My portrait of Manchiki was hanging on the wall, at about eye level, exactly between the two speakers. Bare, not yet framed. It looked like a natural part of the room, as if it had been hanging there for a long time. A painting I'd basically created in one intense sitting. Yet in this study, that uninhibited aspect of it felt, strangely enough, neatly contained. The unique feeling of the place comfortably stilled the painting's plunge-ahead vigor, and unmistakably concealed within that painting was Manchiki's face. To me, in fact, it looked like Manchiki himself was contained within. I had most definitely painted that painting, but once it had left my hands and become Manchiki's possession, hanging on his study wall, it had transformed into something beyond my reach. Now it was Manchiki's painting, not mine. Even if I tried to comprehend something within it, like a slippery, nimble fish, the painting would slip out of my hands, like a woman who'd once been mine, but was now someone else's.
What do you think? Doesn't it fit this room perfectly?
Manshiki was referring to the painting, of course. I nodded without a word. I tried putting it in lots of different rooms, but in the end I knew this was the best room and the perfect spot for it. The amount of space, the way the light hits it, the whole atmosphere is perfect. What I enjoy most is gazing at the picture from that reading chair. Could I give it a try? I said, pointing to the reading chair. Of course, go right ahead. I sat down on that leather chair, leaned back into the gentle curve it inscribed, and rested my legs on the ottoman. I brought my hands together on my chest and once more gazed at the painting. As Manshiki said, this was the ideal spot from which to appreciate it. Seen from that chair, a chair so comfortable it left nothing to be desired, my painting hanging on the wall in front of me had a quiet, calm persuasiveness that took me by surprise. It looked like almost a completely different work from when it was in my studio, as if it had acquired, since coming here, its rightful life force, or something like that. And at the same time, it seemed to have severed any contact with me, its creator. Manshiki used a remote control to turn on some music at just the right low volume, a Schubert string quartet I was familiar with, composition D804. The sound coming out of those speakers was clear, fine-grained, refined, and elegant. Compared with the sound from the speakers in Tomohiko Amada's home, which had a simpler, unadorned tone, it seemed like different music altogether. Suddenly, the commendatore was in the room. He was seated on the stepladder in front of the bookshelves, his arms folded, looking at my painting. When I glanced at him, he shook his head slightly, signaling that I shouldn't look at him. I returned my gaze to the painting. "Thank you very much," I said to Manshiki as I rose from the chair. "That's the perfect place to hang it." Manshiki beamed and shook his head. "No, I should be the one thanking you. Now that it's found a home here, I'm liking it more and more. When I look at it, I feel like I'm standing in front of a special mirror. I'm inside there, but that's not me entirely. It's a little different me. When I stare at it for a while, a strange feeling comes over me." As he listened to the Schubert, Manshiki again turned his attention to a silent appraisal of the painting. The commendatore, still seated on the stepladder, likewise gazed at the painting with narrowed eyes, as if teasingly imitating him, though I doubt that was his intention. Manshiki glanced over at the clock on the wall. "Let's go to the dining room. Dinner should be just about ready. I do hope the commendatore shows up." I looked at the stepladder. The commendatore was no longer there. "I think he's already here," I said.
"I'm glad," Manshiki said, sounding relieved.
He touched the remote control and stopped the Schubert.
"There's a place prepared for him, of course. It's really a shame, though, that he won't be able to enjoy eating the meal."
Manshiki explained that on the floor below where we were currently seated, there was a storehouse, a laundry room, and a gym. The gym was outfitted with all sorts of workout equipment. It had a sound system so he could enjoy music while he exercised. Once a week, a trainer came and led him through strength training exercises. There was also an efficiency-sized residence for a live-in maid. It had a simple kitchen and small bathroom, though nobody was using it at present. There used to be a small indoor pool, but it wasn't very practical and took a lot of upkeep, so he had had it filled in and made into a greenhouse. Someday he might build a 2-lane, 25-meter lap pool, he said. "If I do," he said, "I'd love for you to come over and swim." "That would be wonderful," I said. We headed to the dining room. Chapter 24. Merely gathering raw data. The dining room was on the same floor as the study. The kitchen was in back of it. The dining room was a long room with a large, long table in the middle. The oak table was about 4 inches thick and big enough for 10 people. A solid table that would look good hosting a banquet for Robin Hood and his men. But it was simply the two of us, Manshiki and myself, not a merry band of outlaws. A place was set for the commendatore, but he wasn't there. A placemat, silverware, and an empty glass were ready for him, but they were just for show, a courtesy to indicate that was his place. Like in the living room, one long wall was entirely glass. It looked out over the mountain range beyond the valley. Just as I could see Manshiki's house from mine, my house should be visible from his. The house I lived in, though, was nowhere as big as Manshiki's mansion, and it was a wooden building whose subdued color didn't stand out. So in the dark, I couldn't make out where it was. There weren't many homes built here, but in each of the houses that dotted the mountains, there were clearly lights on inside. It was dinner time. People were with their families at the dinner table, about to enjoy a hot meal. I could sense that slight warmth in those lights. In contrast, on the other side of the valley, Manshiki, I, and the commendatore were seated at that large table, about to begin an eccentric, formal dinner party. Outside, a fine rain continued to silently fall, but there was almost no wind, and it was a typically hushed autumn night. I looked out the window and thought again about the hole, about the lonely stone-lined chamber behind the little shrine. Even as we sat here, the hole was there, dark and dank. Memories of that scene brought a special chill to me, deep inside.
"I found this table while traveling in Italy," Manshiki said after I'd complimented it.
He didn't sound like he was bragging, simply stating facts.
"I ran across it in a furniture store in Lucca, purchased it, and had it shipped here. It's so heavy, it was quite a task to transport it."
"Do you go abroad very often?" His lips twisted up a bit, then relaxed.
"I used to. Part business, part pleasure. Not so many opportunities to do so these days. I'm doing a different sort of work now. Plus, I no longer like to go out much anymore. Most of the time, I'm here."
To indicate more clearly what he meant by here, he motioned toward the house with his hand. I expected him to add more about this change in his work, but that's all he said. As always, he didn't seem eager to say much about his work, and I didn't press him about it.
"I thought we'd start with some well-chilled champagne, if that's all right with you. You don't mind?"
"Of course not," I said. "I'll leave it all up to you." Manshiki made a faint motion, and the ponytailed young man came over and poured cold champagne into long, narrow flutes. Pleasant little bubbles fizzed up in the glasses, so light and thin they seemed made of high-quality paper. We toasted each other across the table. Then Manshiki respectfully lifted his glass to the unoccupied seat for the commendatore.
"Thank you so much for coming, commendatore," he said.
There was, naturally, no reply from the commendatore. As he enjoyed the champagne, Manshiki talked about opera, about how, on a trip to Sicily, he saw a spectacular performance of Verdi's Ernani at the Catania Opera House. The person seated next to him sang along with the performers, all the while snacking on mandarin oranges, and how he'd had some amazing champagne there. The commendatore finally made an appearance in the dining room, though not at the seat at the table prepared for him. Given his short stature, he would have only come up to nose level, hidden by the table. Instead, he plunked himself down on a kind of display shelf diagonally behind Manshiki. He was about 5 feet off the floor, lightly swinging his feet clad in those oddly shaped black shoes. I raised my glass slightly to him so that Manshiki wouldn't see. As expected, the commendatore acted as if he didn't notice. The meal was served at this point. There was an open serving slot between the kitchen and the dining room, and the bow-tied, ponytailed young man brought each dish placed there one by one to our table. For a first course, we had a beautiful dish of organic vegetables and fresh isaki fish, accompanied by white wine. The ponytailed young man uncorked the bottle as carefully as if he were an explosives expert handling a landmine. No explanation of what kind of wine it was or where it was from, though of course it was superb. Menshiki wasn't about to serve a less than perfect wine. After that, we were served a salad of lotus root, calamari, and white beans, then a sea turtle soup. The fish dish was monkfish.
It's a bit early in the season for it, but I heard that down at the harbor they got hold of some excellent monkfish, Menshiki said.
The fish was certainly fresh and amazing. Firm texture, a refined sweetness, but still a clean aftertaste. Lightly steamed, then served with what I took to be a tarragon sauce. Next came thick venison steaks. There was again an explanation of the special sauce, but it was so full of specialized terms I couldn't remember half of it. At any rate, a wonderfully fragrant sauce. The ponytailed young man poured red wine into our glasses. Menshiki explained that the bottle had been opened an hour before and decanted.
It's breathed nicely, and it should be just the peak time to drink it.
I knew nothing about aerating wine, but it had a deep flavor. When your tongue first encountered it, then when you held it in your mouth, and finally when you drank it down, the flavor was different each time. It was like a mysterious woman whose beauty changes slightly depending on the angle and light. The wine left a pleasant aftertaste.
It's Bordeaux, Menshiki said. I won't sing its praises. Just know it's a Bordeaux.
It's the kind of wine that once you started listing its good points, you'd have a long list. Menshiki smiled. Pleasant wrinkles formed at the corners of his eyes.
You're exactly right. It would be very long if you listed its merits, but I don't particularly like to do that with wines. I'm not good at enumerating the merits of things, no matter what they are. It's just a delicious wine. That's enough, right?
I had no objections to that. All this time, the commendatore watched us drinking and eating from his perch on the display shelf. He sat there, unmoving, diligently observing the scene there down to the smallest detail, but didn't seem to have any reaction to what he was seeing. Like he told me once, he merely observes. He doesn't judge or have any partiality toward it. He's merely gathering raw data. This might be how he observed me and my girlfriend making love in bed in the afternoons. The thought unsettled me. He'd told me that watching people have sex was for him no different from watching morning radio exercise routines or someone sweeping a chimney. And that might very well be the case, but the fact remained that it was disconcerting to think of being observed. An hour and a half later, Menshiki and I finally arrived at dessert, a souffle, and espresso. A long but fulfilling journey. For the first time, the chef came out of the kitchen and over to the dining table. A tall man in a white chef's outfit. In his mid-30s would be my guess, with a sparse black beard. He greeted me politely. The food was amazing, I told him. I've hardly ever had anything so delicious. Those were my honest feelings. I still couldn't believe that a chef who made such exquisite dishes ran a small, unknown French restaurant near the harbor in Odawara.
Thank you very much, he said, smiling brightly.
Mr. Menshiki's always been very kind to me.
He bowed and returned to the kitchen.
I wonder if the commendatore was satisfied too, Menshiki said, after the chef had left, a concerned look on his face.
He didn't appear to be play-acting. He seemed genuinely concerned. I'm sure he is, I replied with a straight face. It's a shame, of course, that he couldn't enjoy the fabulous meal, but he must have enjoyed the atmosphere.
I do hope so.
Of course I enjoyed it, the commendatore whispered in my ear.
Menshiki suggested an after-dinner drink, but I declined. I was so full, I really couldn't manage anything else. He had a brandy.
There was something that I wanted to ask you, Menshiki said as he slowly swirled the brandy in the oversized glass. It's an odd question, and I hope you're not offended.
Feel free to ask me anything.
He took a small sip of brandy, tasting it, then quietly laid his glass on the table.
It's about the pit in the woods, Menshiki said. The other day I spent about an hour in that stone chamber. No flashlight, seated alone at the bottom of the pit. The cover was on top and rocks on top of that to hold it down. And I told you, please come back in an hour and get me out of here.
Correct?
That's right.
Why do you think I did that?
I have no idea, I answered honestly.
I needed to do that, Menshiki said. I can't explain it, but sometimes I need to do that. Be left all alone in a cramped, dark, completely silent space.
I was silent, waiting for his next words. Menshiki continued.
Here's my question to you. During that hour, did you ever find yourself, even for a moment, wanting to abandon me in that pit? Tempted to just leave me behind at the bottom of that dark hole?
I couldn't grasp what he was getting at.
Abandon you?
Menshiki touched his right temple and rubbed it, as if checking out a scar.
This is what I mean. I was at the bottom of that pit, a little less than 9 feet deep and 6 feet across. The ladder had been pulled up. The stones in the wall were all densely laid together, and there was no way to climb up. And the cover was on tight. In mountains like these, I could yell at the top of my voice or ring the bell, but no one would ever hear me. Though, of course, you might. In other words, I couldn't get back to the surface on my own.
If you hadn't come back, I'd have had to stay in the pit forever. Isn't that so?
That could be.
The fingers of his right hand were still at his temple. He'd stopped rubbing.
What I'd like to know is whether during that hour the thought ever occurred to you, even for a moment, I'll just leave that man inside the pit. Leave him the way he is. Tell me the truth. It won't offend me.
He took his fingers from his temple, reached for the glass of brandy, and again slowly held it up and swirled it. This time, though, he didn't take a sip. Eyes narrowed, he inhaled the aroma and put the glass back on the table. That thought never occurred to me, I answered honestly, even for a moment. All I thought about was that after an hour I had to take the cover off and get you out of there.
Really?
100%.
Well, if I had been in your position, Menshiki said, sounding confessional. His voice was quite calm. I'm sure I would have thought of that. I definitely would have been tempted to leave you inside that pit forever. I would have thought, this is the chance of a lifetime.
No words came to me.
Menshiki said, down at the bottom of the pit, that's what I was thinking about the whole time. That if I was in your position, I would definitely consider it. It's a strange thing. You were the one on the surface, and I was the one at the bottom of the pit. But all that time, I was picturing me on the surface and you at the bottom.
But if you'd actually abandoned me in the pit, I might have starved to death. I might have turned into an actual mummy, ringing a bell.
You're saying you'd be okay with that?
It's just a fantasy. Or delusion, perhaps. Of course, I would never actually do that. I was just imagining the scenario, just mentally playing with the concept of death. So don't worry. What I mean is, I find it hard to fathom that you didn't feel the same temptation.
I said, weren't you afraid, Mr. Manshiki, being down at the bottom of that dark pit all alone, thinking that I might be tempted to abandon you there?
Manshiki shook his head. No, I wasn't afraid. Deep inside me, I may have actually been hoping you would.
Hoping I would? I said, surprised. That I would leave you down in that pit?
Exactly.
In other words, you were okay with being abandoned down there?
Don't get me wrong. It wasn't that I was okay with dying. Even I still have some attachment to this life. And starving to death or dying of lack of water aren't the ways I'd like to go. All I wanted was to try to get closer to death, even if just a little more. I know that boundary is a very fine line.
I thought about what he said, though I still couldn't grasp what he meant. I casually glanced over at the Commendatore, still seated on the display shelf. His face was bereft of expression. Manshiki went on.
When you're locked up alone in a cramped, dark place, the most frightening thing isn't death. The most terrifying thought is that I might have to live here forever. Once you think that, the terror makes it hard to breathe. The walls close in on you and the delusion grabs you that you're going to be crushed. In order to survive, a person has to overcome that fear, which means conquering yourself. And in order to do that, you need to get as close to death as you possibly can.
But there's a danger to that.
Like when Icarus flew close to the sun. It's not easy to know how close you can go, where that line is. You put your life at risk doing it. But if you avoid approaching it, you can't overcome fear and conquer yourself.
Precisely. If you can't do that, you can't take yourself to the next level, Manshiki said.
He seemed to be considering something, and then suddenly, at least it seemed sudden to me, he stood up, went over to the window, and looked out.
It's still raining a little, but not so hard. Do you mind going out on the deck? There's something I want to show you.
We walked up the steps from the dining room to the living room, and then out to the deck. It was a large deck with a Mediterranean tiled floor. We went over to the wooden railing and gazed out at the valley. It was like a tourist lookout, and we were afforded a view of the entire valley. A fine rain was still falling, more like mist at this point. The lights were still on in people's homes across the valley. It was the same valley, but viewed from the opposite side like this, the scenery looked transformed. A section of the deck was roofed over, with a chaise longue beneath it, for sunbathing or perhaps reading. Next to it was a low, glass-topped table to put drinks or books on, and also a large planter with a decorative green plant and a tall piece of equipment of some kind covered in plastic. There was a spotlight on the wall, but it wasn't turned on. The lights in the living room were turned down low. I wonder which direction my house is, I asked Manshiki. Manshiki pointed to the right. It's over there. I stared hard in that direction, but with the lights out and the misty rain, I couldn't locate it.
I can't see it, I told him.
Just a moment, Manshiki said, and walked over to where the chaise longue was. He removed the plastic cover from the piece of equipment and carried it over. It looked like a pair of binoculars on a tripod. The binoculars weren't big, but looked odd. Different from normal ones.
They were a drab olive green, and the crude shape made it appear like some optical instrument for surveying. He placed this beside the railing, pointed it, and carefully focused.
Here, take a look. This is where you live, he said.
I squinted through the binoculars. They had a clear field of vision with high magnification, not your typical binoculars that you find in a store. Through the faint veil of misty rain, the far-off scenery looked close enough to touch, and it definitely was the house I was living in. The terrace was there, the lounge chair I always sat in. Beyond that was the living room, and next to it, my painting studio. With the lights off, I couldn't make out the interior, though during the day, you probably could. It felt strange to see, or peek into, the place where I lived.
Don't worry, Manchiki said from behind me, as if reading my mind. No need to be concerned. I don't encroach on your privacy. I mean, I hardly ever turn these binoculars on your house. Trust me. What I want to see is something else.
What do you want to see? I said. I took my eye from the binoculars, turned around, and looked at him. His face was cool, inscrutable as always. At night on the deck, though, his hair looked whiter than ever.
I'll show you, Manchiki said.
With a practiced hand, he swung the binoculars slightly to the north and swiftly refocused. He took a step back and said,
Please, take a look.
I looked through the binoculars. In the circular field of vision, I saw an elegant wooden house halfway up the mountain, a two-story building also constructed to take advantage of the slope, with a terrace facing this direction. On a map, it would be my nearest neighbor, but because of the topography, there was no road linking us, so one would have to go down to the bottom of the mountain and ascend once more on a separate road to access it. Lights were on in the windows, but the curtains were drawn, and I couldn't see inside. If the curtains were open, though, and the lights on, you would be able to see the people inside. Very possible with binoculars this powerful.
These are NATO-issue military binoculars. They're not sold anywhere, so it wasn't easy to get hold of them. They're bright, so you can make out images well even in the dark.
I took my eyes away from the binoculars and looked at Manchiki. This house is what you want to see?
Correct. But don't get the wrong idea. I'm no voyeur.
He glanced through the binoculars one last time, then put them and the tripod back where they were and placed the plastic cover over them.
Let's go inside. We don't want to catch cold, Manchiki said.
We went back into the living room and sat on the sofa and armchair. The ponytailed young man sidled over and asked if we'd like anything to drink, but both of us declined.
Thank you very much for tonight, Manchiki said to the young man. Feel free to go now.
The young man bowed and withdrew. The commendatore was now seated on top of the piano, the black Steinway full grand. He looked like he preferred this spot to where he had been sitting before. The jewels on the top handle of his long sword caught the light with a proud glint.
In that house over there, Manchiki began, lives the girl who may be my daughter. I like to see her, even if it's from a distance.
For quite some time, I was speechless.
Do you remember? What I told you about the daughter my former girlfriend had, after she married another man? That she might be mine?
Of course. The woman who was stung by hornets and died. Her daughter would be 13, right?
And Shiki gave a short, concise nod. She lives in that house with her father. In that house across the valley.
It took a while to put the myriad questions that welled up in my mind in some kind of order. Manchiki waited silently all this time, patiently waiting for my reaction. I said,
In other words, in order to see that young girl who might be your daughter through the binoculars every day,